I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. We're learning more about the Orlando shooter, Omar Mateen, including an interview with his first wife about their violent relationship. Shortly after they were married, he became verbally and physically abusive. He didn't allow her to call her parents and only let her leave their home to go to work. Her parents literally rescued her in 2009 after just a few months of marriage. Is there a connection between domestic violence and mass shootings? About half of mass shootings, most of which take place in private in the home, involved a current or former intimate partner or member of the family. A professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health said if someone has demonstrated past violent behavior, it's probably the best indicator we have of the risk of being violent in the future. We have two guests who have joined us. Janine Lazitsky is executive director and president of Women Against Abuse, the leading domestic violence service provider here in Philadelphia. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Also joining us is Azadeh Alai. She's an assistant professor of psychology at Queensborough Community College in New York. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Azadeh, let me begin with you and begin actually with a piece that you wrote in Psychology Today. This was before the Orlando shooting, but you talk about an overlooked link regarding mass shootings, whether private or public, is often involves incidents of domestic violence. Why do you think this is overlooked?
Well, unfortunately, it's overlooked for a host of reasons. I think one is that our culture, in terms of the media landscape, is very quick to look to quick fixes or quick descriptions of why mass violence occurs. And mass violence, unfortunately, is multi-causal. It's very complex. There's a cocktail of risk factors. And as you mentioned, to start, the best predictor of future violent behavior is oftentimes past violent behavior. Unfortunately, we live in a culture where domestic violence is not always taken seriously. It has a legacy of being perceived as a private matter. It's very stigmatized, and so there's not that visibility or public policy that's protecting women in these situations the way that it could be.
Well, let me turn to you, Janine, picking up on what Azadeh was just saying there. Interestingly, I don't want to spend the hour talking about Omar Mateen, but in all the discussion about him, there's talk about, well, was it a mental health problem? What are his ties to terrorism? And only sort of as an afterthought, Janine, was this question about domestic violence. And we're learning more about what certainly his first marriage was about.
You know, domestic violence is a pattern of coercive behaviors with a purpose to control someone else and terrorize the individual. So there's similarities between it. Now, you know, we don't know. We know 57% of mass shootings are related to domestic violence directly. But what about the other 43%? And I would be curious to know if the doctor has thoughts on that. You know, what percentage of those mass murderers have a history of either domestic violence as an adult or witnessing domestic violence as a child? You know, what we know is that violence in the home begets violence in the community. So it's not so surprising, although it's surprising that we haven't talked more about the huge implications of violence in the home.
Should we, though, think of domestic violence as a form of terrorism, as having some of the features of terrorism?
Domestic violence has been referred to as intimate terrorism. So I think that, you know, those connections have been made.
Azadeh, let me go back to you. Looking at some of this analysis, FBI 2009 to 2015, 57% of mass shootings involved a spouse, a former spouse, a family member. 1998 to 2008, 40% of female homicide victims were killed by former or current intimate partner. So we need to really focus on this connection between, I guess, what, mass shootings and domestic violence.
Yeah, absolutely. As Janine mentioned, domestic violence is a type of intimate violence or terrorism. And oftentimes what the research suggests is that domestic violence serves as a psychological training ground for a larger, more massive type of attack. So those could be the early warning signs, for instance. The type of features that we see for perpetrators of domestic violence often also overlap with the features that we see for perpetrators of more massive types of shootings, for instance. The fact that they're male, obviously. You also oftentimes see that, as was mentioned, control is a big part of domestic violence, as is fear. The individual might actually, ironically, feel powerless or out of control in their own lives, and so they exert or assert that control over someone else, oftentimes someone who is in a helpless or, a position of lower status, for instance. And unemployment is oftentimes also a risk factor for more public iterations of violence, which could also be a risk factor for intimate partner violence as well. And obviously, the gun culture, the being socialized within a gun culture, is a big part of it. And so there's a host of factors that tend to overlap. There's a sense of entitlement that's rooted in violence against women, and that sense of entitlement oftentimes also extends to more massive or public types of shootings, for instance.
You want to add to that, Janine?
What we started with is that the doctor was saying that mass violence is very complex and domestic violence is very complex. And I think that we in our culture think, why doesn't she just leave, or what, these simplistics, we boil it down to that. And the truth is there's many good reasons why the victims generally don't leave, because they're so afraid. And, what we know is that when they try to leave, it becomes the most violent time. And they're often killed more frequently when they're trying to flee. So we need to deal with this issue on multiple levels, not only on direct interventions, but all of our government agencies and mainstream systems need to be screening for and intervening earlier into family violence. And we need to address our social norms that allow all of this to occur.
Is it also involve a kind of hyper masculinity? I was reading some of the profiles of some of these mass shooters where domestic violence or some form of intimate violence was part of their profile. Is there a kind of notion of controlling either women or controlling children, a kind of hyper-masculinity, you think that's at stake, Jenny?
I don't want to say hyper-masculinity, because masculinity is a positive thing, not a negative. But I would say that certainly certain social norms can teach and train that and reinforce those ideas of women and children, being second-class citizens or being there just for the pleasure and the needs mm-hmm. of the male.
Azadeh, you want to add something to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. I think you could say it's a perversion of masculinity as well, that a lot of times when we use the term hyper-masculinity, what we're really saying is that an exaggeration or a distortion of our regular norms of masculinity can lead to violence, for instance. And there is evidence to suggest that the Orlando shooter was a misogynist, that he made sexist comments, that he did not have favorable views towards women, that he saw women more as sexual objects, for instance. There were complaints in previous places where he had employment. And oftentimes, if we were to use the term hypermasculinity or perversion of masculinity, homophobia is embedded in that as well. And I think that that's where you really see the ISIS connection. I don't know how much perversion of Islam or religiosity played into the Orlando shooter. I think it was more the kind of cultural components of ISIS, where they're using, women on a massive scale in terms of sexual slavery, and homophobia is a big part of their ideology as well. So I think we should also, not ignore the fact that there was specific hatred towards homosexuality, and that he specifically targeted an area that was known within the LGBT community, for instance. That's also another part of the piece that can be marginalized as well within our society.
And certainly this case, I think, reflects so many of these various complications. Azadeh, if I can go back to you, how much of this, whether we're talking about perhaps terrorism or also talking mm-hmm. about domestic violence or intimate partner violence, is grievance-based, whether the grievance is real or not, but this perceived feeling of grievance?
Yeah, that's really hard to quantify. Another commonality you see among perpetrators of these types of shootings is that they have this chip on their shoulder, for lack of a better word, exactly like what you're saying. They feel as if they've been wronged in some kind of way. That's where that sense of entitlement also comes into play, where they feel as if they're entitled to certain things, or that they've been cheated or treated unfairly for whatever reason, for instance. I was listening to a piece by Cenk Uygur on the Young Turks, and he made this comment of why are they all losers? And I don't think he meant it necessarily like that, but this sense of, there's this commonality of deficiency that they have in their lives, that they're not necessarily doing well in a lot of different areas of their lives. That's where the grievance could come from.
Janine, you had mentioned the fact that oftentimes for the victims or the people that are being abused by an intimate partner, that once they leave or make steps to leave, that can escalate the violence. I'm also thinking about getting that protective order. I mean, going and trying to use the Justice Department or law enforcement to protect them and perhaps even protect their children. Is that also kind of a red flag for a perpetrator?
It is. And I think, sometimes the systems interacting with survivors think, oh, well, get a protection from abuse order, and then, we can help you. For example, in the Philadelphia Housing Authority, their domestic violence transfer policy, several years ago, it was that you needed a final protection from abuse order in order to get approved to transfer to another unit because you were being stalked by an abusive partner. Well, what we know is that some people, if they get one, it puts them more at risk. Mm-hmm. Or, the perpetrator may kill a family member or a dog to get at as a threat, carry through with that. So we work with survivors to determine how can they become safe. If a protection from abuse order is going to work for them, great. Then we help them with that. We have attorneys who are stationed in civil court in both of the protection from abuse order courtrooms and represent people right on the spot.
We're almost up on a break here, but if not that, if not a protection from abuse order, what would protect a person?
Then we do specialized safety planning. The Philadelphia Domestic Violence Hotline, which is 24/7, and people can call in at 1-866-723-3014. We work with the caller to do safety planning in every domain of their life, so we can figure out how in their life can we help to get them safer. And if that means a safe shelter, then that's available as well.
Well, we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, talking about some of the connections between mass shootings, mass violence, and domestic violence. Our guests are Janine Lazitsky and Azadeh Alai. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And like a lot of programs, we've been focusing on the mass shooting in Orlando. Today, we want to take a slightly different look and talk about the fact that most mass shootings take place in the home and often involve intimate partners, children, family members. And again, talking with Azadeh Alai, assistant professor of psychology at Queensborough Community College in New York, wrote a piece in Psychology Today that caught our eye. Also with us, Janine Lazitsky, executive director and president of Women Against Abuse. That's located located here in Philadelphia. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY. Is there any way to know, Janine, in Philadelphia or the Philadelphia region, just how common domestic violence is?
The reason why we don't know is because systems don't screen for domestic violence. So the only way we know is when people present to the police. And there's over 100,000 domestic-related incidents per year here in Philadelphia. And we know that it's something that's underreported. You know, what we know is that one in three women in their lifetime will be a victim of serious physical violence in an intimate relationship. And, you know, so at any point in time, it's less than that. Younger people are more at risk for sexual assault and stalking. But when you add things like poverty, what you do is have another layer of oppression. So it makes it much harder to get out. And
for a poorer, let's say a poor woman,
yes,
to get out.
Yes, much harder to get out. So we think that in Philadelphia, the rate is higher than it would be for the national average. So it's a lot. And when you think about, if it's one in three women in their lifetime, all the children who are part of that family and how it impacts our society.
You mentioned this earlier when we began our conversation as a day, which is that, mm-hmm. you know, we don't talk a lot about domestic violence. And even again, going back to this horrific shooting in Orlando, was it a question of mental illness? Was there a tie to ISIS? And domestic violence, I mentioned this earlier, it sort of came lower on the list of possible connections or reasons for this. Why don't we talk more about this?
That's a great question, and that's the frustration of researchers and scholars, and I'm sure people in the trenches like Janine, is that, you know, acts of violence specifically aimed at women just continue to be marginalized in our culture. You know, unfortunately, we live in this culture where certain voices are just not properly heard, and for whatever reason, we turn a blind eye oftentimes to domestic violence. We see it as a private affair, or a lot of times, unfortunately, we have victim blaming, where there's this presumption, as was mentioned earlier, well, she could just leave, for instance. She's choosing to stay with him for whatever reason. So this kind of complicity in not offering resources, not giving exposure and visibility to all the reasons why a woman might feel trapped or might not have the resources to get out, for instance. We're even seeing that victim blaming to a certain extent with how his first wife has been treated, because there's not necessarily documentation for all of the allegations of abuse and violence that she reportedly endured. There are many people questioning the authenticity of the accounts that she's giving. Mm. So there's this sense that women need to prove or authenticate these experiences. And intimate partner violence, it happens behind closed doors. So it just doesn't get that level of attention.
Janine, you mentioned the fact that it's really when the police get involved, that's when we learn more about this. I was watching a documentary about O.J. Simpson and his relationship with Nicole Brown Simpson, the numbers of times that she called the police, but she did not, you know, she did not, in a sense, want to go down and report this about her husband. How common is something like that?
Very common, and it goes back to the fear that's involved. And, you know, there's a cycle of violence where there's an incident, and then there's a period that we refer to as the honeymoon phase, where, you know, it appears that maybe the person is really going to change this time. There's so many issues. There's common children. There's cultural values that might keep a person from leaving, certainly economic considerations, and fear. Just paralyzing fear.
Fear that if I do something, I won't be able to get out and
I'll be
hurt
killed.
Again.
I'll be harmed. My kids will be harmed. I'll lose my kids, because the truth of the matter is that usually in these relationships, there's an imbalance of power, obviously, and even financial controls are taken by the perpetrator. So if they need to get out, how do they get their kids if they don't have money to hire a custody attorney? That means that the perpetrator gets a custody attorney, and they don't, and it becomes very difficult.
We've been using the word intimate partners to describe some of these relationships. Let me go back to you, Janine, but Azadeh, I'd like to get you to weigh in on this as well. If someone isn't married, do married spouses get more protection from the law? For instance, if it's stalking or if it's some kind of abusive relationship, if someone is married, is the law more protective of them, or does intimate partner cover pretty much everybody?
There's no discrimination for that. It's, you know, I don't think so. But the question is, how would judges apply it? You know, that's a more nuanced question.
Yeah. Azadeh, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah. I this is not my area of expertise, but from what I've been reading from the perspective of gun ownership, it does make a difference in terms of if the potential restraining order or allegation is against someone who's married versus someone that we're cohabitating with versus a same-sex relationship, et cetera. So from the perspective of gun laws, that does have significant implications. I also wanted to return to Janine's comment regarding that cycle of violence, because that's a really important point as well. It's not just a cycle of violence, it's also a continuum of violence. So there is a gradual escalation in terms of the level of intensity and violence that targets of domestic violence experience. So it's not as if on the first date or even necessarily the fifth or the tenth date that immediately the individual is abusive. And a lot of times there's a psychological abuse that pervades the relationship before it escalates to physical acts of violence, where the individual has already been isolated from loved ones, for instance, has already been controlled in other ways, has already had their sense of self-worth or self-esteem undermined, so that by the time it escalates to actual physical abuse or violence, they might feel alienated from others in their lives, they might feel disconnected, they might feel as if they have no recourse or that they even deserve the abuse, for instance, which is then reinforced by others who might also victim blame. So it's an entire kind of continuum of violence that's occurring, which makes it that much more complex.
Sure. And Azadeh, do we know what percentage of mass shooters also engaged in domestic violence? Has there been research that has looked at that?
Well, we know that about 70% of all mass shootings happen inside the home, actually not out in public. So the majority of mass shootings that are occurring are actually not shootings like the Orlando one or, you know, shootings that happen in public places that tend to get more attention. The FBI defines mass shootings as when there are four or more casualties, and the majority of those happen behind closed doors when you're talking about an intimate partner, a wife, an ex, children, and then oftentimes the perpetrator then turns the gun on themselves, for instance. But those don't receive the same level of attention because of the fact that, again, it's within that sphere of domestic violence, and mass shootings out in public are perceived as threatening to everyone within the culture, and they appear to be random and unpredictable. So there's also that fear that was mentioned attached to it.
Anything you want to add to that, Janine? Then I do want to get some callers in on the conversation.
No.
Okay. That's Janine Lazitsky, Executive Director, President of Women Against Abuse, joining us by telephone. Azadeh Alai, Assistant Professor of Psychology at Queensborough Community College in New York. In fact, Azadeh had a piece recently in Psychology Today looking at some of these connections between mass shootings and domestic violence or intimate violence, and we wanted to build a show around that. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join the conversation. Let me get Jeff from Wynwood. Jeff, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I'm an assistant adjunct professor at Temple, and I usually run a nice little survey near the beginning of the course, and I ask students to raise their hands. How many people in here consider themselves feminists? Mm-hmm. And it's usually me, and if I'm lucky, maybe two other female students. And I think that in terms of like the way that you're, I totally agree with your commentators on the fact that this is, you know, to use Raymond Williams' terms, a very highly overdetermined, you know, phenomenon that has a lot to do with, you know, both the media. I think it's indicative in, you know, Donald Trump's campaign and the misogynistic, sexist comments he's made that are appealing to, you know, white working class men who obviously.
Well, Jeff, I don't want to get too far away from our conversation.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, my point is that I think that a lot of this violence, you know, stems from, you know, a deep. I think there is a hyper-masculine element to. I mean, there's a reason why the Columbine shooters chose that particular mode of rebellion, and the images of women and women's empowerment and what it means to be a feminist and what it means to be a man is so driven by our cultures. You know, it's Bruce Willis. It's, you know, and when I hear in class, you know, then I follow it up by simply asking the class, do you believe women should have, you know, just be paid the same as men? They all raise their hands. Well, then you're a feminist, aren't you?
Well, you know what, Jeff? Let me take your comments, and thanks for calling into Radio Times. Azadeh, sounds like you want to say something.
Well, I can just relate to that because we do sex and gender in my social psych classes, and there's something about the term feminism for recent generations where it's just a very loaded term, and it's a very misunderstood term. I think that there's such a kind of stereotypical negative depiction of what it means to be feminist that students think if they raise their hands, they mean that they hate men, for instance, or they're really militant, or, you know, they're trying to change the culture in ways that are going to be problematic. So they don't entirely understand what the term feminism means. Mm. And I think what the caller is also getting at are two very prominent kind of systemic institutional influences, which is, one, we still live in a patriarchal society. So unfortunately, there's still supremacy in terms of male dominance, and that filters through our mass media, our educational systems, so many of these socializing agents regarding how we think about masculinity and femininity. And unfortunately, we also live in a rape culture. So rape or sexual violence against women, it's normalized, it's excused in our culture, it's commonly portrayed in our media and popular society. Women are regularly objectified. So all of that is playing a role and then filtering down to ideas that perpetrators like the Orlando shooter have about women, about violence, about his own masculinity, all of that. It's like that cocktail of risk factors that I alluded to earlier.
And it should be said that even if we all live within this culture, it's the rare person that carries out the kind of violence that we saw in Orlando. Let me read a comment, an email from somebody who says, what is missing is that abusers are committing crimes and not being prosecuted until it's too late. A woman is being abused, arrest the abuser, protection orders miss that point. Jeannie, I mean, I think what the caller is saying, or what the writer is saying, is that it's easy to prosecute these cases, just arrest the guy and take care of it from there. Sounds like you're saying it's more complicated than that.
Well, I think what the emailer is saying is very true. We've spent a lot of time over the last decades looking at services for victims. You know, what can we do to get the victim safe? And the question about holding the perpetrator highly accountable, but at the same time offering alternatives to violence. Right. So I think we need to hold perpetrators a lot more accountable. The accountability is very low, the threshold. But I also think that we need to have more programs and services for alternatives to violence so that we can start to change these ideas, these norms, and
I mean, you're saying
people's behaviors. So
therapy, group therapy, talk therapy, things like that.
Yes. It's very specific. It's more like cognitive behavioral therapy with high levels of accountability through a group modality.
Do you agree with that, Azadeh?
Yeah, I also would say that, you know, we're a culture that sensationalizes violence, and we don't really have a lot of access to peace building and conflict resolution either. That's not a common way in how we socialize our boys or our girls, for instance. So in a culture where you have access to guns, where you're inundated with violent imagery, for instance, oftentimes, particularly for males who have grievances, as you mentioned, or have other types of risk factors, violence becomes a very rational, normal outlet for them to express their grievances, especially in a culture that tells boys you can't cry, you can't express yourself emotionally, that portrays anything feminine as being weak, for instance. Oftentimes, aggression and violence becomes the only outlet for males to express themselves. Of course, this is not excusiology, but it's just trying to explain and understand the mentality of the perpetrators. I would also just like to add, I've purposely not mentioned the shooter's name because I think that in the aftermath of these types of mass shootings, one of the goals of the perpetrators is they want to achieve that notoriety. They want to achieve that infamy. And, you know, I think that it's the responsibility of media that we should not conform to that. We should focus on the victims. We should focus on prevention, as Janine mentioned. And so I purposely do not mention the shooter because I think that that's just conforming to one of the goals that they have for these types of attacks.
About a minute or so before we have to end our conversation, Janine, thinking about someone who has been able to get out of one of these domestically violent relationships, what do they need in order to heal themselves?
They need immediately trauma-informed and trauma-sensitive case management and therapy as a way to move beyond that. And also for their children.
I was thinking about the children.
The kids come and they're so traumatized. Many times they can't speak and, you know, they should be. And within a week after being in our safe house or a couple weeks, they're laughing, talking. You know, it's amazing what a little bit of trauma-informed care can do. It's really about creating safety for them immediately in their life and helping them to move forward and to have options and opportunities to, you know, live an autonomous and free life. It's really about freedom.
And not falling into patterns that created the problem in the first place.
You know, I have to point to the perpetrator. We need to address it there.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Azadeh Ali, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Assistant Professor of Psychology at Queensborough Community College in New York, Janine Lazitsky, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Executive Director, President of Women Against Abuse. We have a third guest waiting in the wings, Michael Hirsch, talking about his piece in Politico magazine. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoing. Coming up next on Radio Times, getting back into shape after neglecting, ignoring your physical fitness. We'll talk about overcoming the mental and physical barriers. That's Radio Times at 11, right here on WHYY.
Republican leaders evoke a higher power for convention delegates.
The last thing I would do is tell anybody to do something that's contrary to their conscience. Of course I wouldn't do that.
House Speaker Paul Ryan hints at the virtues of freedom for delegates as the last chance to finally stop Trump. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscoing, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We were just talking about domestic violence and mass shootings. Joining us now is Michael Hirsch. He's national editor for Politico magazine, and his new article, Why Didn't the FBI Stop Omar's Mateen, is about the new and evolving threat of domestic terrorism. Michael Hirsch, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
So is Omar Mateen an example of this new kind of terrorist?
Well, I would use the word new carefully. It certainly is an evolving trend. We've had lone wolf terrorism of various kinds, around the country for quite a while. But the FBI got very used to searching for organizational operational links, evidence of travel abroad, in the past when they were dealing with earlier iterations of Al-Qaeda or even when ISIS first arose on the scene. And what we've seen now is several data points that indicate that self-motivated, self-starter terrorists, if you will, like Omar Mateen, who aren't obviously radicalized right until right up at the end, can suddenly act and have no links of any kind to speak of. And in the case of Mateen and Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the Boston Marathon bomber, right, we learned that the FBI essentially dropped and closed their cases when they decided that there was no threat because they could detect no links to another into a terrorist organization. In the case of Tsarnaev, there was the FBI said to Customs, "Well, let us know if this guy travels abroad." And of course, even though he did travel abroad once, it was not right before his terror act. So the point is, I think the FBI is looking for indicators based on an old model, and the newer model is the Omar Mateens of the world.
Well, and as you write in this piece, he was clearly not an observant Muslim. He used drugs and alcohol, frequented gay clubs, gay websites as well. It's sort of unclear exactly what that was about. He seemed to be enraged when he saw two men kissing, something his father talked about. And I guess the question is, is he I don't mean this just in a minimizing way. He's just a violent killer who made confusing phone calls to 911 when he was carrying out this mass shooting.
Yeah, strikingly, when I spoke to law enforcement authorities for the article I wrote, the person they compared Mateen most with was Dylan Roof, who just a year ago, actually last week, shot up that African-American church in Charleston. And the reason they compared him to Dylan Roof is because in both cases you had a loner who was desperate to commit some terrible act, some kind of violent criminal impulses that we may never know, but was looking for a justification for it. In the case of Dylan Roof, his interest in white supremacist groups really grew just shortly before he committed his act. And in the case of Omar Mateen, from what we're learning, his conversion, if you will, to ISIS, his swearing allegiance to ISIS, was just a last-minute thing. This was someone who was not obviously radicalized. And so you do have cases where you're talking about violent criminal impulses. You're talking about mental illness, clearly. If you look at the whole entire life of Omar Mateen, this was a very disturbed young man. And this is the kind of thing the FBI needs to shift more toward looking and to develop some kind of an intervention policy, which is possible. I mean, it's somewhat controversial, but the FBI, I learned, has already been working on this. It's just only in the last two or three years. And strikingly, at the time that the FBI first interviewed Tamerlan Tsarnaev and Omar Mateen back in 2013, 2014, they hadn't really developed this sort of community intervention policy that they now are doing, but it's still in its infancy.
Well, and there is a belief system, I don't know if it's true or not, that somehow these acts are predictable, that if we can piece together all the events that led up to carrying out a mass shooting, then we can figure out how we can prevent the next one. Does that make any sense to you?
Not really. I mean, you talk to law enforcement experts, it's very difficult to predict when someone will erupt. But what you can do is try to involve the community. Clearly in the case of Omar Mateen, there were indications from schoolmates. There was even a call to the FBI at one point from someone who prayed with him at the same mosque, who was disturbed by some of the things Omar Mateen was saying, about terrorism. And I think the key for the FBI and law enforcement and intelligence is to figure out how to turn this into, a regular policy. Now, The FBI has developed something called shared responsibility committees, which is a sort of Orwellian name for the way they're trying to involve communities without necessarily profiling, but Muslim American communities in identifying people who might go bad, who might commit something, and trying to bring in an imam or a psychologist or educators. In the case of Omar Mateen, who knows? Maybe it wouldn't have been stopped. But what we do know is it was never even tried. And all of these troubling signs over all the years of his young life. The FBI interviewed him three times.
That's right.
And still dropped the case. And, you know, you have to think to yourself, it's got to be a better way, right?
Well, and as you write, the FBI seemed to think that once he got married, I guess remarried, that they thought that whatever beliefs he had would somehow recede to the background and he could live as a married couple. Of course, I'm thinking about the married couple in San Bernardino.
Exactly.
I mean, are there different questions you think the FBI should ask, or is it more like a mindset of the FBI and how they think about a domestic terrorist?
It is a mindset. I mean, this is a, you know, classic law enforcement organization. They look for an actual plot. They are there to prosecute. You know, there's always been a difficulty in, whether you're dealing with domestic violence or anything, in acting against someone who might be dangerous but who hasn't done anything yet.
Right.
You know, there's a question of civil liberties. There's a question of the Constitution. But that doesn't mean that it always has to be law enforcement. Now, interestingly, one of the things that the Secret Service does when it's tracking someone who they think might be threatening or has made a threatening statement against the president, but that doesn't necessarily warrant an arrest, they have a whole intervention policy that they've pursued for 30 years, the Secret Service does, where they will try to get help to the individual. They'll, you know, keep abreast of what the individual is doing. So there are some law enforcement officials who think that the FBI really needs to fully embrace this type of model, without, of course, treading on people's civil liberties. It's a tough line to walk.
Well, it is. I mean, the president, it seems, gets slightly special protection because you can have vile and hateful ideas and ideologies in this country, and you're allowed to express them and believe them.
Right. But in intervention, where you're soliciting calls from the community, does not necessarily mean arrest or a violation of one's rights. I mean, when I looked into this further, for example, the city of Dearborn, Michigan, which has the largest Arab American population in the country and has become a focal point because of some radicalization that's occurred there. I mean, they actually have a really healthy policy where the local police chief in Dearborn, Ron Haddad, has an award ceremony every year where he gives people awards based on whether they've helped law enforcement. And in many cases, he says, families and communities and mosques, they want to help, whether it's local law enforcement or the FBI, because they want to, you know, everyone wants to prevent someone like this from acting out before they actually do it. And so if there is a method to do this, if there's actually a phone number to call where you can bring in, a psychologist or an educator or a counselor, then that, you know, at least creates the possibility of prevention, which we don't really have right now.
And that's Michael Hirsch, national editor for Politico magazine. We're talking about an article that just published in Politico, Why Didn't the FBI Stop Omar Mateen?, about this new and, I guess, evolving threat of domestic terrorism. And again, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Michael, there's a Facebook comment, a guy that says, sounds like the FBI may have inadvertently pushed him into the attack. Is there any evidence of that?
No. I think in the sort of twisted thinking that we've learned that Omar Mateen was engaged in, look, it's impossible to probe, but clearly he grew up in a very strict family, a father who was overtly anti-gay. It appears that Omar Mateen did have gay impulses. You know, perhaps he was going through these terrible conflicts over that issue. He made some comment at one point about, hoping that the FBI would raid his home so that he could go and turn himself into a martyr, which ultimately he did. But look, you were dealing with a very disturbed individual. I don't think anyone could have predicted that he was going to erupt in precisely the way he did. But the point is that going back to his days in high school, when, you know, there were incidents of violence, clearly there were issues with this guy. It is, very odd that, considering some of the things he said, the FBI did ultimately just stop tracking him altogether. Even after he had made, comments sympathetic to ISIS, here we found he was able to go out and buy an entire arsenal of guns, and then head over to this nightclub without anyone knowing about it.
Yeah, you mentioned this article, and you mentioned just a couple of minutes ago about you don't have to go to a place like Saudi Arabia, for instance, to get radicalized, that you can use the internet. And one of the people that you talked to talk about being radicalized between the ears. And again, you know, how do you prevent or intervene when someone is thinking these kinds of scary and violent thoughts?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, we have now had, since the Boston Marathon bombings, this is the third of these self-radicalized incidents here in the United States. It sounds rather cold to describe it that way, but these are three really important data points that I think law enforcement has to look at. And I think that it's incumbent on them to continue with this model of community intervention, which, as I said, they've already started, but it's still relatively small. And to realize, look, it's no longer as important to look for an operational link, to look for someone who has been directed by or has been in contact with, you know, ISIS in Syria and Iraq, or has traveled abroad to meet with ISIS in Syria and Iraq. That obviously is significant, but it doesn't. That is not the only indication they should be looking at. So, I mean, I think that the FBI and intelligence are going to be clearly looking at this in the same way that we're discussing it as intensively now. Yeah. And I'm sure that, you know, when we next talk about this, there will be questions about civil liberties and profiling. And that's a very, very delicate line that they have to walk. But that doesn't mean they shouldn't try to improve their model. I don't think you're going to see the FBI simply dropping the next suspect who is not shown to have traveled abroad or have, you know, direct operational links to ISIS.
You mentioned with profiling. You think there will be more profiling as a result of this case?
Well, it's, you know, obviously they deny it. And if you actually look at the incidence of extremist violence in this country over about the last 25 years or so, there was actually a Department of Homeland Security study that I cited in my article. Mm-hmm. It actually is far more incidence of right wing extremist violence of the Dylan Roof variety than you'll find in Islamist violence. So, you know, I don't think it's entirely accurate to say with Donald Trump that the enemy is simply radical Islam. Obviously, there is an issue there with sympathy to Islamist violent groups, particularly ISIS. We saw that in San Bernardino. We saw that here. And we saw that in the Boston Marathon bombings. But we shouldn't, you know, kid ourselves that this is the only potential violence. And the Dylan Roof killings a year ago are perfect evidence of that. I think the FBI is going to have to find a way to track and intervene in the cases of, you know, violent, disturbed people who make threats on the Internet, create manifestos, as Dylan Roof did, or say the kinds of things that Omar Mateen did. Mm-hmm. Because clearly, as we just discovered this week, our gun laws are not going to be changing anytime soon. So there needs to be another way.
Well, let me pick up on that. We actually did a show about this yesterday, why the Senate, there were four bills that were voted on and voted down yesterday, not able to get the 60 votes to pass any of them, two from the Democrats, two from the Republicans. Why was the Senate incapable of coming up with some kind of compromise that would address, I think, a problem that probably most of the Senate and certainly most of the population thinks is real?
You know, we keep going through this question each time.
Yep.
There's a terrible incident, most memorably, right after the school shootings in Connecticut, when all those small children died, there was a huge push, and the NRA, the National Rifle Association lobby, is incredibly powerful, and we see this in spite of changes in the polling, I think there was just a new CNN poll that showed that there was at least support for more background checks. It's a terrible situation in which the politics is simply paralyzed.
Unfortunately, we can't get our caller on, but this is a Seeley from Bethlehem saying had a son or has a son who struggled with mental illness. He became violent, joined white power groups. Once he got medicine and was treated, he returned to his old self. And Michael, there are ways to intervene and help people who clearly are struggling with a whole host of identity issues or other psychological issues.
Yeah. And, again, it's not as if the FBI is not aware of this. The FBI is working on this, but it's only really been in the last 2 or 3 years that they have actively adopted this community intervention model, where they have FBI agents who have are in regular contact with different communities around the country where there might be an excess of violence, not just Muslim American communities, but also including Muslim American communities, and they have a regular meeting of educators, imams, and so forth, where troubled individuals are discussed, and if need be, they're intervened with, and so you can get someone the medication. A lot of the, obviously, you're dealing with severe mental illness here, whether it's a Dylan Roof or an Omar Mateen, whether it's a right wing ideology that attracts them, or whether it's ISIS extremism, it's still mental illness, so you have to deal with it that way.
Michael Hirsch, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. National editor for Politico magazine. We've been talking about his article, Why Didn't the FBI Stop Omar Mateen? And that's it for the first hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back. Shifting gears.